5 seconds. We have complete clearance for launch. We are go. 20.
9.
Guidance internal. Location sequence start.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Howdy, neighbors. May the Lord bless you.
We figured out a long time ago that it's much easier to control people when we're all watching the same TV shows, listening to the same radio stations, going to the same movies, looking at the same billboards, eating the same food, and speaking the same language.
Talking about my life. I can't seem to get that through to you. I'm not just talking about one person. I'm talking about everybody. I'm talking about form. I'm talking about content. I'm talking about interrelationships. I'm talking about God, the devil, hell, heaven. Do you understand? Finally!
All will obey Santa in this new world order. Oh, yeah.
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
That sounds like a lot of...
There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immense
interwoven,
multinational dominion of gods. Multinational dominion
which will produce and control hallucinations to the point that it will change human reality.
PSYOP Radio.
Decoding the psychological warfare machinations within paranormal and parapolitical landscapes. PSYOP Radio.
Howdy, everybody. This is Miles Lewis.
And Mac White.
And it is another Sunday evening live from Austin, Texas. This is PSYOP Radio, and we're transmitting from the American Freedom Radio Network, and we've got a very interesting show tonight.
Yeah.
Special guest who seems to be new to the JFK assassination scene and has some quite extraordinary claims mm-hmm. about his somewhat intimate connections to various players, alleged participants in the conspiracy to assassinate an American president.
JFK.
And this is Roderick A. McKenzie, and he'll be joining us after this first break. But next week we've also got another guest. Mm-hmm. We're going to have Supreme Commander James Mosley, who is the editor of one of the oldest-running flying saucer magazines in the mm-hmm. country, and that is gone under various names over the years, but it's currently called Saucer Smear because, well, he often traffics in rumor, innuendo, and just out and out, scandalous material.
That's going to be a fun show.
It's going to be a fun show, and he's a done everything from grave robbing in South and Central America to exposing the truths behind the UFO and Men in Black phenomena. So that's going to be a hoot. But I've been hard at work preparing for this upcoming monthly event series going on, put on by the Anomaly Archives nonprofit community group that I'm a member of. And we're going to be doing a monthly Flying Saucer Cinema Series this summer. We're kicking it off a little early, but it's already summer here, as you can feel outside.
It's close enough.
Beginning Memorial Weekend, Saturday night, May 29th, at the South Austin Popular Culture Center, formerly the South Austin Museum of Popular Culture, we're going to be having a monthly showing under the stars of some kind of film that's significant to the UFO, to our culture's experiencing of UFO phenomena. And we're going to start this one off with an incredible, fun film that I love dearly, and that's Quatermass in the Pit, a.k.a.
Oh, that is a good one.
5 million years to Earth.
Yeah.
And Quatermass predates, I believe, even Doctor Who, but he's a very Doctor Who-type character.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of strange Fortean and ancient astronaut and poltergeist phenomena.
Sounds fun.
But we'll be right back with our guest, Roderick McKenzie, talking about the JFK assassination. Stay tuned.
Was a friend of mine.
Welcome aboard, everybody. Welcome back to PSYOP Radio. This is Smiles Lewis.
And Mac White.
And we have a very special episode for you tonight. We've got a very special guest who is, as I was saying, seems to have recently popped onto the scene and has a very interesting story to tell. And did he know Lee Harvey Oswald? Well, we'll find out a little bit more about that. This is, Mac, why don't you introduce
our guest? Yes, Roderick McKenzie is a very interesting individual. He's a Korean War veteran. He worked in the carnival and circus for years. He's been an acrobat, a registered nurse, a sign painter, an artist, and he's a multifaceted individual. And he's got this amazing story about the JFK assassination. Rod, are you there?
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome, Robert.
Okay, great. Glad to be there.
Well, Rod, you've got quite a story to tell, and
that's
what's that?
That's what people tell me.
Yes, it is quite a story, and I guess the best thing to do is just start at the beginning and tell how you came to know these guys, mob bosses John Roselli and Sam Giancana, and how you ended up in Dallas in 1963. How did that happen?
Okay, it goes back to when I got discharged from the Presidio of San Francisco. I met Morgan, Bill Morgan, and William Alexander Morgan. I met him, and he was on a ship that Barney Gould, the newspaper man, had brought down from Seattle to San Francisco. And they gave me a job on it, as I just got discharged, and I'd hung out at this bar in San Francisco. And I got a job with, I noticed that Morgan had a lot of money, and he was doing burglaries, and I got into that business with him. Now we got to sort of run out of San Francisco because we got some heat. The mob told us we're working for the mob. And they told us to, get time to leave. And we just beat the police out of there. Headed down to Los Angeles, San Francisco to Los Angeles. And then Bill Morgan knew people at Goebbels. Animal farm, and my family had been around, had been in the animal business back in New Hampshire. I was raised as a wild animal farm, not as an animal, as a person. And we met John Roselli at a party at this, Del J. Graham had gone. And Dillon himself was quite a person. He was mob, and he was had aerial acts, and that was my first taste of flying trapeze business. But we met these people, and Roselli knew the people up in San Francisco that we knew. And so one thing led to another. We started doing burglaries down there around L.A. and out towards Las Vegas. And got heat again, and it was time to go. We started heading to carnivals and so on and so forth all across the southern United States, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Sebring shows, Alamo expositions, and so forth. And Morgan was getting itchy pants. He had been a mercenary and done some hairy things in his life. As a whole, you can look on the computers, look up with William Alexander Morgan, you'll get a whole thing on him. And he wanted to go back to Cuba. He'd been there, so we headed down to Miami. And we'd been up to no good for about 3 or 4 or 5 months, and going all around to the south and southwest. And we headed to Cuba, went over on the ship, the ferry boat to Cuba. And Rosselli had given us, John Rosselli, had given us an address to go to a fellow named Lewis McWillie. So we went and found him at the El Presidente Hotel. And he gave us a job as I was working at the service bar, learning to be a service bartender, and Morgan was in the kitchen. He didn't like it. He got involved with these student revolutionaries and went out in the field with them, and he disappeared, but I kept track of him. And I started... I have this identity kit that I had around the carnivals that I made to make phony ID. And I started making IDs and papers for Morgan and his people, Student Revolutionary Council, which was bigger than Castro's army, actually. And on this end of the island, not on the east end of the island, not the western end like Castro was. And they were having some pretty good victories, and I'd go up into the boondocks to see Morgan and bring him radios and telephones and things like that. But they weren't all headsets for radios, things like that, and some ammunition, whatever we could get our hands on, food. Razor blades. They wanted razor blades with these in the shave. I didn't figure that one out. And I made them out in the cane field. And it came to notice the Batista's police, which was a little bit of a hairy situation there because, you know, making ID for those people could get you tortured. So McWillie came to me one day. He said, look, if you're going to make ID and you're pretty good at it, he said, there's a fellow I want you to meet. He said, took me to meet this Abe. And Abe said he was with the Defense Intelligence Security Command. No CIA or anything like that. It was DISC. And he said, well, we'll send you to school. Well, I have nothing else to do. What the hell? I go to school. Sent me up to Fort Detrick, Maryland. I went to what they call the identification and papers school. Seals and Flaps was the nickname for it. Flaps with envelopes and making seals. Yeah, I went to Fort Detrick and spent 3 weeks there learning whatever nefarious things they teach you. I knew most of it anyway. I'd been around print shops and photography and knew all these things. Quite a bit of it anyway.
Yeah.
And you've got to realize there weren't a lot of Xerox machines in those days. They were out there, but there weren't many of them. And so I come back to Cuba after I graduated this ultra-secret bunch of people, and I started making ID for Abe. And he sent me out to see Morgan and with a couple other characters. I go up there and deliver things that they want me to deliver. And they said, well, I come back, and one day, you know, this is all happening within months, not a lot of time. Because we're going to send you up to, you know about carnivals, and we want to put a safe house on the carnival back end. Said, we're going to send you up to Chicago to meet some people, and they'll put you to work. I go up to Chicago, and Sam Giacano, who I had met before, not on a talking basis, but I'd seen him before, and I end up sitting in this old brewery with a guy named Gino LaMata, who's one of Sam's guys, and they give me a freezer truck, several old vehicles, and a trailer, and we make it into show equipment, grill show, back-end show, a number of concessions, top-rate concessions, brought in some Union carpenters and built them to my specification. And, of course, I didn't really know that much about the carnival games and stuff at that time, but I BS'd my way through it. And they were searching for somebody, so they found somebody, and that was me. So I go out with the shows with this safe house on the back end of the carnivals, and it's just go on like we're, well, like any concessionaire, lay down our equipment, pay the privilege, work the show, whatever day it is. Went to Tampa, headed to Davenport, Iowa with straight shows. Oh, no, Royal American shows, I'm sorry. And then Royal American was going into Canada, so they, the people I contacted every couple of days told me that I couldn't go into Canada right yet. They didn't want to take the equipment into Canada. So I said, well, where should I go? I said, well, where do you want to go in the United States? I said, well, New England, I'm familiar with. I'm from up there. So we went up and laid down our stuff on Continental Shows, which is a crooked show, you know, it was at that time. Everything worked in those days. Today you can't lay down anything that will make you any money. Unless, you know, unless you own the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everything's Sunday school today, what we call Sunday school. And we ran this show, New England, the hopscotched over to World of Mirth shows. Where, then when they decided they'd let me go into Canada, and I went up for the Ottawa Fair, Eastern Exposition there in Ottawa, and then back into Vermont and down to King Reed shows and around New England a little bit over to, it don't matter, a whole bunch of shows. Then we headed out west. I was getting people by now that were being sent to me by this Reverend Bourne and a couple other people. Some of the people at that J.M. Wave bunch down in Miami. And we're getting these people, putting them to work on the carnival, teaching them the carnival business. And Gino had become a regular carny by this time. Of course, he was watching over me, too, you know. I'm not supposed to know this, but I was supposed to be the boss, but he really was. And so we head over to Rogers and in Wisconsin, Rogers Carnival, and then we go from there over to Artie Thomas and the Dakotas and play there, and down over to Seabrand at Great Falls, Montana, and down through Utah, down to Phoenix. Yeah, Seabrand winters in Phoenix, so we take equipment, put it mostly in the winter quarters there, and head out. So with these people I've still got with a couple of concessions to work over in California with a couple of shows there, Crafts and Foley and Burke, and then back down around L.A. again. And got real friendly with Mr. Rosselli there, and I never called him John in those days. I do now, but you know, I always called him Mr. Rosselli. At that time, he was Mr. Giacana. And I did some burglaries again, and I was running the safe house end of this thing, and these guys were sitting, you know, around L.A. They had just in various rooming houses and doing whatever they did, and I only had two clients by then, a girl and she was a hit lady, and we did finish the winter down around California and in Mexico, in and out of Mexico. We had the girl show going in and out of Mexico, and Gino LaMotta was really getting into the girl show thing. So we're going to these different meetings on, by this time Castro had come in, and they were having these meetings about how to kill Castro that was going on. We'd go to those things every now and then, And that was in Louisiana and Texas, Beaumont, and Nacogdoches, and Shreveport, that is, those areas. And either Gino or myself would go, and one of us would take care of the show stuff. And we're in another Seabrand's Carnival Winter Quarters a lot. Then we did the same show thing the next year, which would be been about 51, and then same route all the way around again, down to Arizona again, from the Dakotas down to Arizona. And we were getting clients from this Reverend Bourne, whatever, ACC churches. And he had a place down in Mexico, and I guess most of these guys were men. And the one lady, she stayed with us a lot. And Martinez was her name. And we were back around Seabrands for that winter, and then comes 1952, come back into the, we're ready to go out. I turn over a vehicle and end up in Pima County Jail, and my ID factory ended up strewn across the desert.
Uh-oh.
And, yeah, oh my crap, it's all over the desert. State Trooper comes along, and I'm in a coma, not in a coma, but black, I can't see. So they take me to the hospital at Wilcox, Arizona, and the FBI comes in on it. I get busted, and all this ID, passports, everything else I've got. And I contacted John Rosselli. I had a phone number, and in LA at his suite. Well, he didn't get back to me, but all at once I'm let out of jail in the middle of the night at Pima County Jail, and it's 12 o'clock at night. They let people out, expect you to walk back to the city, you know. No, Pima County Jail's underground way out
there. Oh, boy.
No, it doesn't matter. So a guy named Irvin LeBaron is waiting for me, picks me up. I didn't know what was going on. He says, you're coming with me. Now, he was a Mormon with a lot of wives. And I went with him down to a place. We went to a place, and well, first to Douglas. We stayed overnight at Douglas, Arizona, and to Agua Prieta, and then down to Tanana.
Rod, we've got a break coming up.
We'll be back on again.
We'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to PSYOP Radio. Our guest tonight is Roderick A. McKenzie, and Mr. McKenzie, you were leading us slowly towards Dallas.
Yes, you had just gotten out of jail. And
on that.
Yes.
Tanana, Mexico is where we're at right now. C-A-N-A-N-E-A, I believe it was. And that was right over the border in Mexico. Irvin LeBaron had this compound there. He's the guy, by the way, that ended up later on, they did a book on him, Four O'Clock Murders.
Hmm.
And he was a Mormon polygamist that got in a lot of trouble down there. Yeah, that was later in the 70s, I guess. So anyway, I go across. I stay there for a little while, a week maybe. And it's really great there. I had good food. There was a woman there and everything else. Forget all that. Anyway, the girl takes me. They tell me I'm going to Houston to meet some people. And she takes me all the way across Route 10 into the States, you know, into the States again, into Route 10, all the way past where you are, and Austin and Houston. to Houston. We stay at the lady and I stay at the Travelers Hotel. I guess it isn't there anymore in Houston. It used to be a Carnival Hotel, crummy joint. And we stay there that night, and I'm supposed to meet some people. And we go over to a gay bar and meet them, and it's Dave Ferry and two Latin guys. They told me they were going to pick us up in the morning, and I'm going up to Dallas. And don't tell me why or anything else. And you never ask questions in those days,
mm-hmm.
these people. I was making money. Why did I care? You know, I had nothing else to do. And it comes the next morning. They come in a Cadillac, and they pick me up. And they take me up in the sky. It wasn't new, but it wasn't very old either. Cadillac up to Dallas. And that's where I met... Mac Wallace. He was. They took me into the Cabana Motel. They put me up there, and then put me at the Egyptian Lounge. I met Mac Wallace, and we had the whole clandestine deal where we both wore the same shirt and all that business, and so that we'd know each other. I didn't know Mac Wallace. I had known Dave Ferry before. And I knew Frederick Rogers, who was in the car, too. So they go their way, leave me with Mac Wallace at the motel to meet Mac Wallace the next day, which I do. And he seems to be an amiable guy, so they get nerdy looking with big glasses and square jaw. And very well-educated, presents himself well, but he drinks a lot. He's got this flask and... gives me some of this wild turkey that he's got. And I, one shot of that was enough for me. I went back to beer. It was, in those days, I don't know if it still is in Texas, it was set up and you couldn't order a mixed drink in those days.
Oh, yeah, those were the old days. It's changed.
they still have that?
No, not anymore. Dallas is a wide open city now.
So I get to meet everybody. I meet Wallace takes me over to Jack Ruby's club, the Carousel, and I go over there and meet him upstairs. Meet him, and I had some fun there. He introduced me to a lady, sort of, and I meet. To all these people. I met Tippett there, and I met, finally, we went back. First I had met Miranda, Jake Miranda. I met him, too, Mac Wallace had had me meet him at the Egyptian Lounge. And he comes in. Both of them got suits on, and this weird Hawaiian shirt that he and Wallace and I have. He's like under his suit. You knew he was uncomfortable, uh-huh. but I didn't. I just, that's all I had on. It was warm. And so we go over the Carousel, and I meet Mr. Rubenstein, and I didn't like him right away, even though he was pretty nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he fixed me up with a gal right there and then, so that was not
What
bad.
Was there about Jack Ruby you didn't like?
Just the demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
The boisterousness, the demeanor. There was just something hidden underneath him that I call him the penguin. he reminded me of a penguin in a suit. And big guy, you know, he was big and not big, you know. The act is big.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, he took fucking shots at people and things like that, and I didn't like that. He got a couple of signs out of me later on. I painted signs for him, but it was all done through a third party.
And you got to know Tippett pretty well, right?
Well, Tippett I met right there that day, and he was to meet me the next day and take me to the safe house to take over the safe house, which I did up on Holland Avenue in Dallas. Holland Street or Holland Avenue. I guess it was Holland Avenue. And I had also, Ruby had said he could get me whatever I wanted. But what I wanted to go to work, as well as run the safe house, which was as a surgical nurse. And he said, sure, we can fix that up. So they did. They fixed me up with Dr. Sparkman over in Baylor University Hospital, St. Anne's, actually. And then he got me into Baylor University Hospital, Truett Center, in surgery up there. I worked there for all the time I was in Dallas, except what to the end of it, where they put me over in Parkland. But that's getting ahead of the story. And so I get the safe house, which is a glorified garage, a coach house, up on Holland Avenue, and it's nice enough. I've got my own little apartment, very small apartment, and shower and bathroom. Plus, the clients have little cubicles and with doors on them. But and there's a little day room there, pool table, and clients start coming in after a couple of weeks. But I'm already working at Baylor by then, and that's what I wish I could find a record to prove that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
At Baylor. I know somebody can get it. I went there later on and tried to find out if I had worked there. They wouldn't help me out at mm-hmm. all. So those records are all gone, you know.
Yeah.
So, but if anybody wants to look into this stuff that I was there, they can look that up. You know, I don't have the finances or the
mm-hmm.
resources to do so.
So you managed this safe house, and there were a lot of interesting people that came through there to stay over the
right.
next few months.
There was an assortment of Latin people and Corsicans and Frenchmen, and they were all going to or coming from whatever they did. I assume it was hits.
Mm.
In fact, I know a couple. I was cleaned up after them. I got notes and papers and things like that. Boy, you'd like to have those now.
Mm-hmm.
Mertz was one of them. He, one that I got to know pretty well. He ordered a lot of wine and stuff, specialty stuff.
Now, this is the Corsican?
Yeah. He was with Corsican Course.
Mm-hmm.
That. And later on, I got to know a lot of those guys in Indochina later in the 70s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was well-known in Marseille and over in Indochina, too.
Now, during this time, weren't you also making a false ID to be used in...
Making all kinds of IDs.
Yes.
They gave me back my... somehow, somebody had salvaged... The state troopers had got... Somebody had salvaged the whole ID setup. And it had been all over the desert floor. Now, how they did that, I don't know. And they say that there's supposed to be no record. I don't know if there is or isn't, of the FBI busting me in on that deal. I don't know if there is. There should be a record of Pima County when I went there, but because it was under Rod McKenzie, and there should be some kind of record there. That I don't know. These things. Of course, I don't care one way or the other whether anybody proves it or not, because I'm just telling the story. If they don't like it, it's fine. If they like it, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do this for notoriety. I ended up getting a little bit. I didn't really, wasn't thinking of it when I did. It was more of a thing to get it out of my system.
Yeah. Now, we understand that there was a lot of false ID being used during the Kennedy assassination, false Secret Service ID.
I'm sure I made quite a bit of it. In fact, I know I did.
You made Secret Service ID?
Secret Service, yes. We made that. We made some FBI IDs and cards. Cards mm-hmm. for all of them as well.
What about Oswald? Did you make one of... he was carrying some ID.
That Heidel thing that Joan wanted to know about, yeah. Mm-hmm. I made... That name rung a bell. Yeah, I did make that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in New Orleans. I made that on Canal Street.
I see.
I had a place up in above the Sailor's Bar. I don't think that's still around either.
And you knew Oswald in New Orleans, correct?
Yeah, I knew who he was. I was told he was ONI.
Mm-hmm.
Naval Intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and and to stay away from him because he was John Rosselli had told me that the guy was on the gay side, and that I didn't want anything to do with him. You know.
Did you see him again in Dallas prior to the assassination?
Yeah, over at Ruby's place that one time. That was the only time I ever saw him in Dallas that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
But he and Ruby were buddy-buddy. That was, when I saw them there, that was at his Ruby's club one of the few times I went up there. I was delivering him some signs. And Oswald was there. But he was just one of the regular guys that I used to know was around that bunch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You never asked any questions what somebody did. That wasn't the way you dealt with people. You were what you were, and they were what they were, and you didn't. Everybody was compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. You didn't ask any questions. It was a sure way to get, well, you lose your payroll and end up who knows where.
Yeah.
Yeah, those people, they didn't play games. They whacked people as soon as looked at them.
So you're in Dallas managing this safe house and making up these IDs and so forth, and all this time you have no idea that Kennedy is coming to Dallas or that there's even going to be a plot or anything?
No. It came out a couple of days before he came into town. Well, a week maybe he was coming in. I didn't give it any thought. You know, I was making money. I was playing around with this the gambling thing with this bunch of Texas millionaires going to the Lamar Hotel down in Houston, and up working this what they call a stick in our business, working the outside of the table so that the house gets in, you win for the house.
Mm-hmm.
I worked that with around. Oh, that was the Lamar Hotel and the Dolphus. Lamar was in Houston. The Dolphus was in Dallas. And we had a suite of rooms, in both of them, where these millionaires came in. And they were, you know, I saw everybody, even the FBI came up there with those people, Hoover and Tolson. And there were a whole bunch, several CIA men that I knew of, guys from that JM Wave, they used to come there.
Mm-hmm.
This David Morales, who nobody ever talks about very much, he was, I'm sure he was involved in this thing as well as anybody else. And I don't know about shooting, you know, I'm talking about in it some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many people that, you know, you don't know what they were doing there that day. I don't know, we're talking about the shooting day. It was just people from all walks of life there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why it didn't. Somebody didn't know the thing was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before it happened. But, we're getting way ahead of it. But,
Looks like we've got a break. We'll be right back with Rod McKenzie after the break.
Bending news. PSYOP Radio with Mac White and Smiles Lewis, Sundays at 7 to 9 p.m. Central, only on American Freedom Radio.
All right, welcome back. Thanks for tuning in to this live edition of PSYOP Radio. Live from Austin, Texas.
So, Rod, you were about to describe when you first found out that you were involved in this plot to kill JFK. What happened on November 22nd? What is your memory of that day?
I got bogged down here a little bit, but I had made ID for Percy Holt and Rogers and and Harrelson. They had airline stuff and stuff like that, air flying permits and so on and so forth. From Mineral Wells, Texas, they were going to take off. But I had made all this ID for them and under different names. And that seemed funny because they all had their own, well, two of them were pilots as it was. And I had been cut out of my safe house and sent over to the cabana again to stay there for almost a week. And they had made like a war room out of that safe house. There was maps up there and everything else. I'd only been back once or twice, and I was sort of ushered out, get back to the motel and just take, don't bother with anybody, you know? And so I did. I minded my own business and stayed at the cabana. That was a nice place to stay. And I worked at Baylor, and I had the day of the hit, I was told to meet Miranda and Roselli at the Baylor University cafeteria, which is downstairs, and was at that time. I don't know if it is now or not. And which I did. I had gone to a bookstore, and then I went in about 11 o'clock. I guess I met them down there in the cafeteria. And I had a donut and coffee and stuff. And we talked. There was pleasantries. Asked how Del Graham was. He told me that Del was at Astronomy and so on and so forth. And Roselli was back and forth on the telephone all that time, and right up to, I guess, 12 o'clock, right in there. And maybe 12:30, I don't know. Probably when the hit went down, I don't know what.
12:30, yeah.
About what he was doing. But we didn't hear about it for a while. I'm sitting, you know, finally he comes over and he tells me, well, I wouldn't be needed for whatever they were going to use me for. And just to go to work like I normally did at 3 o'clock. I'll get over at 2:30 and get scrubbed in for whatever case was going on. It was a gigantic operating room, X-shaped with 30 operating rooms or something like that. And there was always a case going. That's when I heard about the hit. Was up in the OR. Somebody came come running in, one of the security guys, yelled that Kennedy had been killed. It was no surprise to anybody. It was, you know, and none of us liked Kennedy. None of my people did, because of the Bay of Pigs business. And it was, you know, I didn't think anything of it. Later on, I got a little shivery because I heard about that bullet being put on the stretcher over at Parkland, and figured that might have been what they were going to use me for. Something like that. And, you know, that got a little hairy in your mind.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you start thinking you're into the thing, which I obviously was, but I didn't get used. That was it. Just like the guys on the other side of the railroad trestle, Percy Holt and Rogers and Harrelson, they didn't get used. They ended up being those tramps.
Now, this was a shooting team, you're saying, that you found out later was on the other side of the underpass, and they would have shot Kennedy had he managed to make it through Dealey Plaza.
On the way out if he'd gone through that pass,
And so your job at Baylor Hospital... had the motorcade gone to Baylor instead of Parkland, it might have been you who did what had to be done there. Yeah.
It was like 50-50. If they turned around and come back to Baylor, it's actually shorter than going to Parkland. But I guess they were heading in the direction of Parkland, so they just went that way, under the underpass, and went up Simmons Freeway that way. But, yeah, so I just worked that day and left at 11, like I... 11:30 is when I used to get out of there. And I went back to Cabana, and I went to the Tribune. Well, of course, the Pepsi convention was in at that time. And the night before, I had seen a whole bunch of these people that were, Nixon included, at the Cabana.
Yes, Nixon was in Dallas at the time of the assassination, wasn't he?
He visited the Cabana in the room next to mine with Martino Lorenz was there and Frank Sturgis and another Latin guy. And they were pretty noisy, another girl. They were all in that room. And Nixon went in that room for about a half an hour because I was watching out my window. I had got a little irritated. They were making so much noise over there, music-wise and so on.
Now, these people that Nixon was meeting with were Cubans, correct?
Frank Sturgis was not Cuban. He was
right,
Italian.
Yes.
Viarelli
is
his real name.
And Frank Sturgis later became well-known during the Watergate era.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he and Rodriguez, who was also, I guess he's still alive. He was around that area the day before. I don't know if he was around during the thing or not. But those guys were all in town. There were so many people in town. It is amazing. We're talking nasty people.
Well, Rod, we'll be right back. We'll be right back on the other side of the hour after these messages for a short segment and then some more commercials and a very long segment. Stay tuned. This is PsyOp Radio live from Austin, Texas.